from stpetecatalyst.com.
Welcome once again to Arts Alive, the podcast of the St. Pete Catalyst. My name is Bill DeYoung. My guest today is Amy J. Cianci, MBA, MFA. She is a Jill of all trades, I'm happy to say a friend of mine, and also the director of, engagement director at St. Petersburg Press?
Yes.
What exactly does that mean? You're the head honcho over there.
Yes.
So you engage kind of with everybody who wants something to do with St. Pete Press?
So I basically run the press. It is part of the larger Catalyst Media Group. And it's our local publishing company. The title engagement director is just one of those. It's just one of those titles that it could mean anything to anyone. So that's why I like it, because one day I'm editing. One day I'm helping to create a cover design. I do sort of soup to nuts.
You've done some cover designs for the press, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I didn't admit it at the time, and until the book actually got published, that was the first time I told the author it was my design.
Which one was it? I've forgotten.
Lion of Fire.
Oh yeah.
Brittany Renew.
Yeah, that's right. Amy does lots of things and has a fabulous background in obviously both business and in the entertainment business, which we're going to talk about. But I want to stay with St. Petersburg Press for a minute. It is the local publisher. Can you give me a little background on where it started? It's part of the St. Petersburg Group, as is the Catalyst. But what's the genesis there?
So the lore, which it's now officially lore, was that Joe Hamilton, who's the founder of the Catalyst and the founder of St. Petersburg Press, was having a coffee at the Banyan Cafe with Paul Wilborn.
Right.
And Paul was bemoaning the fact that he had this great manuscript that he'd trotted out for, well over a year and was not getting any attention from the publishing world. He said to Joe, "Wouldn't it be great if St. Pete had its own publishing company?" And Joe said, "Yeah, let's do it." The next thing we know, we're St. Petersburg Press, and Paul's collection of short stories about Ybor City called Cigar City.
So how many years ago was this? 2-3 years?
2018.
Oh, my God. 5 years already.
Yeah.
That's how old the Catalyst is. So yeah. I guess that was early on.
Yep. Late 2017, early 2018 was when they hatched the idea. And by the end of 2018 is when that first book was published.
So someone would approach you and say, "Well, look, I think I have a pretty cool idea." So what do you do? I mean, you have to read it first, or what happens there?
I read everything. I read everything first. We're sort of a hybrid publishing company.
Mm-hmm.
What we saw happening to the publishing industry is a lot like what people were seeing happening to the music industry. It was next to impossible, unless you had a famous last name or, your dad was Stephen King, to get published in this now very commercialized conglomerate publishing world.
And very like the music business.
Very much like the music mm-hmm. business. So the concept that we wanted to, kind of follow the music business with was to sort of democratize publishing. How do we give access to people who really want to be published but don't want to go that way of self-publishing? Self-publishing, it's a fantastic opportunity for those that it's a right fit for.
Yeah.
But it's also a lot of work and can be very daunting to someone who doesn't do it. And if you want to just concentrate on being an author and don't also want to, this sort of part-time job of publishing yourself, mm-hmm. which it does become a lot of work if you try it, you can come to us. And, what St. Petersburg Press does is, we'll meet with the author, I'll read the manuscript, and then, I promise every author the same thing. I'm going to be lovingly honest. And if the author can't accept that level of loving honesty, then it may not be a good fit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, that first follow-up meeting could go in one of two ways. I could sit with the author and say, "Look, this is fantastic. You're ready. Let's do this." Or I could say, "I've got some homework for you. Here's what I think, and here's my feedback, and here's where I think you're standing in this process now."
What happens if somebody, now you've published poetry books, you've published novels,
Nonfiction.
Yeah, yeah, of course,
young
nonfiction.
Adult,
the graphic novel
books.
Was great. About 30 books, I think you told me recently.
We're at
so
36
far.
Right now, oh, and we wow. have another 7 projects rolling.
So, what happens if somebody brings you their poetry and you go, oh man, this is just awful? When, then is it just homework, go tidy it up? Or these are the hard questions.
Again, lovingly honest, if yeah. I don't think the work is a good fit for St. Petersburg Press,
yeah.
or if I don't think the work is ready, I'm going to say that. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is I want the author whose dream it always has been of publishing this book and holding it in their hands and saying, this is mine, this is what I created. I want the very best version of that to be what they end up with, right? Yeah. So if I don't think what they bring me in that first blush is that version, I am going to sit down and work with them, you know, or I'm going to recommend an editor, or I'm going to recommend, you know, a writing coach, or I'm going to I have a sort of reference list of people mm-hmm. that I've worked with,
yeah.
Locally that I would trust, you know, for these people in this situation. My opinion on let's say it's poetry, but it's poetry that, you know, is not my cup of tea. That's where it gets to be a different question. Just because I don't like it doesn't mean it isn't good.
Oh, of course.
Right?
You want other opinions
so
in there, right?
If it's technically good, mm-hmm. and maybe the topic doesn't speak to me, but I think that there is an audience for it, I'm going to publish it. You know, as long as I feel like the writer is going to be a good partner, and as long as I feel like that we're going to do them a good service.
It's quite a process,
yeah.
isn't it? Can you talk about, yeah, I don't know if you have this at your fingertips, but the most popular books. I think that Paul's Florida Hustle has done really well.
Yep. Paul's Florida Hustle has done really well. Yeah. Tom Gribben's Last Florida Boy
oh, sure.
has
yeah.
sold well. Peter Kageyama's Hunter's Point.
He has a new one coming out,
he
doesn't
does.
He? Hunter's Point was beautiful, and we all know that Peter, we know him from his like city work and,
yes.
and the sort of nonfiction stuff. But Hunter's Point was a great sort of mystery novel. Can you share anything about this new one? And when it's coming.
So it is book two of the series. So Katz Takamoto, who was the character he created in Hunter's
Katz,
Point.
Sure, yeah.
Katz is coming back in book two, and it's just as beautiful as the first one. I mean, it's a great noir mystery with a great gumshoe detective in San Francisco again, and it's a really enjoyable cast of characters. It's called Midnight Climax.
Mm-hmm.
That's a funny title, but I'm not going to explain it. I mean, you could check his Facebook page. He's recently posted a little bit more about what the title means. And somebody asked me, this is terrible to say out loud, I guess, but somebody asked me if it was porn, and I said, no, it is not porn. The title has deep meaning, and it's actually a historical reference, such as both of the books are. So yeah, it's a fun one, and the first book sold well. It got really good reviews as well. You know, some of the other lesser known books on our bookshelf have also sold quite well.
Mm-hmm. Well, when does Midnight Climax come out? Let's put that
Midnight
out here.
Climax comes out January 23rd.
Ah,
yeah, we're close. And you know, there's a couple other titles on An Extra Life, which was written by Fabio Dalboni. So that one is also sold very well.
I liked that one a lot.
It was a very, very different story. And
yeah.
this was a fun new challenge. We also published that book in Italian. So we had an English version and an Italian version.
Didn't Fabio write that
he
in Italian?
He originally wrote it in Italian.
Right.
And he had it translated. He worked with a translator to get it into English because he didn't trust his English to start it there. But, you know, we got kind of sad when we were about 3/4 of the way through publishing the book in English that we wouldn't have the opportunity to share the book in its original Italian. And so we kind of chopped and changed a little bit, and we went ahead and published it in Italian as well. So,
do you remember the name in Italian? What is it?
I probably can't pronounce una. It's very similar to an extra life. It's Una Extra Life or something like that. I mean, it's terrible.
Thank you, Fabio.
I mean, my
if
last name is Cianci. I should know how to pronounce it
well,
in Italian.
She's going to work on that. So what we should do really is clarify for people that these books are not just sort of sold at the local gift shop. That this stuff goes on Amazon and it's available around the world.
Yes, yes, yeah. It is available on about 1,000 digital platforms worldwide. worldwide. You can, if you were living in Japan, you can buy any of our books. There's something really special about publishing a book with St. Petersburg Press and having this hyper local experience, and then being able to call your mother in New Hampshire and say, "Hey, go to Amazon and buy this book. Mm. It'll be at your house in 2 days." And it adds a, you know, again, when we go back to this concept of a hybrid publishing model, it adds a really beautiful level of legitimacy to the process. You know, a lot of people think, oh, a small publisher, it's going to have a really narrow audience. It's going to, you know, it's going to only be available locally. But that was never our goal. You know, again, we wanted those people who didn't have the option of getting that big advance check from, you know, Random House and you know, being picked up by one of the big three. We wanted them to have that full publishing experience. Mm-hmm. And while they do pay us a service fee, when they're published, they look and feel just like every other professionally published book on the market.
Well, I mean, they certainly are. I have no question about that. And it's stpetersburgpress.com, and you have the bookshelf there. You can order stuff.
Yep.
Through the website, you got the whole bookshelf there. You're also at Tombolo. Are most of the books are at Tombolo?
Our local book partners are fantastic. So Tombolo Books carries almost one of everything we uh-huh. publish at this point. Book and Bottle, which is Central and Sixth. Uh-huh. They've got several. They're a very curated collection. They have a very specific. Specifically curated collection of books that they offer in that location. So not all of the books that we've published fit with they sell.
Well, but that's going to be the way. Yeah,
we do have several titles with Book and Bottle. We've also got titles on the St. Pete Pier Books gift shop. They carry the vintage St. Pete books.
Yeah,
we have several of our books directly tie into the history of St. Pete and Pinellas County. So the History Museum carries them in their gift shop. We have a couple of books that are carried by the Holocaust Museum gift shop. Mm-hmm. Our local partners are terrific, and we've gotten nothing but constant support and love from the people of St. Pete and Pinellas County.
Well, a big disappointment for me was the fact that I started doing the vintage books, I think, where the first one maybe was 2020-21. Haslam's was already closed. Yeah. And so while I have some earlier stuff from a different publisher, from University Press, they carried them. But my vintage St. Pete books, which are so hyper-local, have never been in the legendary hyper-local bookstore. You know, time goes on. We don't exactly know what's happening with Haslam's, but that's sad for me. Those things should be on the shelf there. I'm going to switch gears here a minute. You have a master's in business administration. And an MFA in costume design. Are you from Virginia originally?
No. I am originally from Sarasota. I'm a Florida girl.
I have even more respect for you than I did 5 minutes ago.
I was born in Florida.
Costume design. Where did you get that? Did you get that in at Ringling or?
No. So I went to Catholic school.
Mm.
Which means I basically spent the better part of 15 years in a uniform.
You're still here to tell the tale. Good
and,
for you.
You know, I'm still a little bit a uniform girl. You know, all my clothes are like granimals. I don't dress like a designer, right? You know, everybody always expected me to like arrive in some over the top, you know, very high fashion. Yeah.
Big sunglasses.
Right. Something very, very mod. And, you know, I was always disappointing them in my, you know, Gap khakis and button down shirt. But I was in the fine arts track in high school, and I had convinced myself at some point, as you know, many creative high school students do, that, you know, academics, even though I'm really good at it, is dumb, and, you know, I want to be a cartoonist. That's what I had decided. In the meantime, I was obsessed with the history of clothing. I had been obsessed with the history of clothing, and I'm not making this up, since I was 11 years old.
Hmm.
I did a project in Girl Scouts to create a lookbook from magazines. And if you've never seen a lookbook, it's basically where you cut pictures out of magazines and, you know, you create a, you know, a series of outfits, uh-huh. you know. And it was, I don't know, some fashion design patch we were all trying to get in Girl Scouts. And I loved doing that so much, I literally never stopped. My lookbook was 17 binders by the time I went to college. I just couldn't stop.
Don't obsess.
So, but at the same time, I got really, really fascinated by the history of, you know, personal adornment, you know, back even to the ancient days. Like, you know, why did humans wrap themselves in furs? Like, at what point did we decide, okay, if we're going to cover ourselves, it has to have flair? If we're gonna, you know, if we're gonna cover our bodies, like,
on,
yeah,
right?
why is it not just like a knotted blanket? Why
I never thought about
you
that,
know?
But okay,
yeah,
you know.
So, so you know, I got deeper and deeper into this in high school, but it was always just a project on the side. It was always a hobby. It was always an obsession, and you know, I could draw, so I was constantly drawing, you know, gowns and things that you know, I enjoyed seeing in some of the history books. I will never forget the moment when I read an article about a costume designer for the Royal Shakespeare Theatre in London. And it was the biggest light bulb aha moment I've ever had. Because I suddenly realized that's a job. Oh my gosh, I don't have to be a cartoonist.
Yeah.
I could actually be a costume designer. This is a real job. I could actually, you know, like I could.
Oh yeah.
I could make money doing this. And
it's
so
what we call the light bulb moment.
Yeah.
Right?
So so within, you know, 30 seconds, I ran out of my bedroom and I announced to my entire family that I was going to do this. I'm going to be a costume designer, and you know, of course they, yeah, okay, whatever. Mm. I'd never been a thespian. I didn't participate in theater in school. I wasn't in any plays, you know. I had to catch up, right? So I immediately joined the theater club. When, you know, that was an eye-opening experience.
This was in Sarasota we're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was in that year's production of The Christmas Carol, which, of course, I did all the costumes, right. Especially in my own.
Yeah.
I was terrible. I was Mrs. Cratchit or something. It was awful. It, you know, I should not be on stage. I learned that very first show. you know, I get nervous. I get sick. You know, I tripped over my own feet getting onto the stage. So I fell onto stage in my big moment as Mrs. Cratchit. it was awful. I'll never do. I never need to do that.
I was once the ghost of Christmas Present with the big robe and the thing wrapped around his head. And you know.
Yeah.
So at some point, you went to school for this.
Yes. Yes. So I went to, as I said, I went to Eckerd College because my mother was convinced that, now my mother, God love her, she's an auditor, right?
Uh-huh.
She's unbelievably intelligent, but it's all this numbers, linear, you know. I helped her in her accounting firm from when I was a kid. So, you know, I knew how to clean up a set of financials, you know, by the time I went to college. My mother was convinced that the costume design thing was silly. So she was like, this isn't a real, you're not really going to want to do this. So I want you to have a real degree as a backup. So we agreed that Eckerd College made the most sense because I could get a liberal arts degree. I could still, you know, stay fully, you know, at my full level academically. And then, you know, if I graduated, I could do anything with that. I could go, you know, go to graduate school, like, anywhere with a liberal arts degree. So that was our deal. and art school was far too expensive. And, I had to get scholarships just to go. So I got to Eckerd College and I, you know, first week there, I went directly to the theater department and I said, I want to meet your costume design teacher. And they said, we don't have one. Well, let me see your costume shop. Well, we don't really have one of those either. We have this space where there's some sewing machines stored. I said, okay, well, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to be your costume designer and I'm going to run your costume shop. I just told them this. I mean, I'm like,
nice.
I'm a freshman. There's,
nice.
You know, this was at the time.
And they didn't just show you the door immediately.
No, they were like, oh, okay, great. Our first show of the season is Into the Woods. Here's the script. Good luck.
You got a witch. You got a Red Riding Hood.
Yeah,
what do you got?
They had like, I don't know, $200 to do the whole show.
Wow.
And I had a blast. And I proceeded to, you know, turn that little corner they gave me into a real costume shop. I costumed everything they did for the next 4 years. And then I did internships in professional costume shops in the summers. And that was really where I realized, oh, I got a lot to learn. You know, I knew how to sew. Both my grandmothers sewed, and they had taught me the basics. And then I was teaching myself anything more complicated than that. And When I did my final project for undergrad, I did a series on corsetry because over the years I had gotten obsessed with basically female body modification. Although body modification is a very ancient art and it wasn't restricted to just women, it had hit this unbelievably ridiculous height, right? So by the time we got fully into the era of corsetry, we were putting women through some really crazy stuff to get the shape of, you know, of fashion.
Yeah.
Right. Nowadays, women still do it, but they're doing it with plastic surgery and not a set of stays. So I had gone from, you know, knowing how to sew in my bedroom to 4 years later, I'm doing a final project and creating, you know, replica corsetry. It was pretty crazy. And then I got accepted into the graduate program at Virginia Commonwealth University, their MFA costume design program, with a full scholarship and an assistantship. So I came in as a teacher and a student, and it was fantastic, and I learned a lot. But after my first year, my dad passed away, and he was very young. He was 49 years old, massive heart attack at work. And that changed the entire dynamic of my family. And I did not get to go back. I didn't get to finish that MFA. When I left, I was the youngest person in the entire graduate program at Virginia Commonwealth that year. Mm. And I was a straight A student always. I'm just that kind of geek. And it was the first time at the time, it was the first time Virginia Commonwealth was going to offer a main stage production to a second year costume designer. And unfortunately I had to step away from all that. It was something I thought I was going to regret my whole life. In the end, despite, you know, things people told me that, you know, I wasn't, you're never going to be this, you're never going to be that, I ended up having a really wonderful and enjoyable career as a costume designer in Florida, in the St. Pete and Tampa Bay area. I've worked for pretty much every theater within a 50-mile radius. I designed all over the place. I traveled, you know, when I could, and I took gigs out of town when I could. I was able to work on several Broadway productions, most of which only lasted a couple of days after opening. But, you know, you still worked on Broadway.
It was all about the costume.
Whether the show ran for 2 days or 20 years, yeah. Right?
Do you know Katrina Stevenson?
Yes.
Who, you know, does she?
Yes. And I think Job Site is the only theater I did not design for, because Katrina had it well under control.
Sure.
When
I know you
when
did. You did work with Oslo.
Yes.
And down in Sarasota.
Yep.
And American Stage, I believe.
I ran the costume shop for American Stage for 6 years.
Wow.
And then I worked in the costume shop at the Oslo for almost 8 years. I designed all kinds of stuff at both places. I've designed for Free Fall Theater, which is fantastic. I've won awards. I worked for the Boston Symphony. I worked, as I said, I did a couple of great things for Broadway that, you know, I was not the designer, but I worked on the show.
Well, how do you transition from that into more administrative stuff and into what you're doing now with the St. Petersburg Group and with the press and everything else?
So I never lost that business side of my brain. You know, when you're freelancing, when you're running a shop, you're running a business. You know, you might be running a business of one, but you're running a business. You know, I was an entrepreneur for a very long time as a designer. And then, you know, when you run your own shop and you're running your own, you're running your own production teams, you still have that business side. You know, a lot of people, you know, they think, oh, you're just this creative being and you're drawing beautiful things. And well, yeah, I mean, that's a slice of it, but you know, I'm essentially I was project managing and being an entrepreneur and running a business for all those years as well.
Well, that's what people talk about all the time, about the business of art, you know, that you can be an artist, you can create beautiful things. You can even run a studio, but to run a gallery, to run a business and to sell yourself and to make it work, to make a living at it, that's a different cup of tea entirely.
Yes. And, you know, I've even, At certain points in my career, I even did classes with artists on, you know, how to turn, you know, how to be more of a business person.
Yeah.
And it's hard. I mean, it's hard, especially when you're trying to do all of it yourself. At one point, my husband, who is still in the industry, he still has sort of one foot in the industry. Mm-hmm. He does scenery. He's run a scenic shop for a lot of years, and you know, 2004, 2005, you know, we started a company for him for, you know, in themed environments and scenic building. And, you know, I wrote the business plan. I mean, these are skills that artists have to have. And, you know, I'm thankful that the way I was raised and, you know, who my mother and father were, I had that savvy. It really made a difference. But I got to a point with the costume design where, you know, it's intense. It's fantastic. It's wonderful. It's exhausting. It's, you know, you love doing, but when you're in it, and you know this, Bill, mm-hmm. because you've done stuff like this, it consumes everything.
It'll wear you down. You don't have hobbies.
You know, and people like to be entertained at the holidays, so you don't have holidays either. You're mm-hmm. working holidays. I was working full time at whatever shop I was working at the time, and then I was designing on top of that. So I had to carry 3 or 4 shows freelance in addition to working full time to make a decent living in what I was doing and to stay in this market, because I really love the Tampa Bay area. Yeah. I could have easily moved to Chicago. I was offered jobs all over the place, and I could have made more money doing exactly what I was doing, but I loved this area.
You know, it's funny. I've said this before with other creative types who are sitting in where you're sitting right now, that sometimes I'll have, you know, book events or book signings, and none of my theater friends, and I've got a lot of friends in local theater, I'm very blessed that way, have ever come to any of them, because they're always working.
Yeah.
They're always busy at night.
True.
They're in rehearsal, or they got a show,
yep.
or they're taking much needed time off from rehearsing another show.
Yeah. it's true. You don't have hobbies.
Yeah.
You get to see your family, you know, after opening night, you know, and as I said, I was never on the stage. But you know, you work project to project, and the second one project comes down, you're well into the next project. And, you know, again, it's a revenue stream thing. You know, you can't say no, because if you say no,
may not be another job.
There may
for
not
a while.
Be another job
oh, yeah.
for a while.
It's the old so conundrum of the
it,
artist.
Either
yeah.
it's, you know, when it rains, it pours. But, you know, you also don't want a drought. So I reached a point. It's been over a decade now where I was burnt out. I still loved what I was doing, but I didn't love it enough to not, you know, it was a lot of introspection where I basically told myself, okay, you're exhausted, you're burnt out, this isn't as fun as it used to be. And at that point I was like, okay, if I'm not having fun, I'll do something else for a little while,
mm-hmm.
and then it'll come back. And I did. I shifted gears. I started working for a local property management company.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'd run, you know, basically run a business for, you know, the previous 20 years, you know, I had connections in property management. My mom does audit, always did auditing for property management. And, you know, they had a part-time job for the summer doing accounts payable, which was, oh my gosh, that was awful. but within a week, they lost their payroll person. And they knew I ran payroll. They knew I could do it. And, you know, they asked if I was interested in the payroll position. I said, yeah, why not? So I did that. And then that led to a job in human resources. And that led me to get certified in human resources. So uh-huh. I'm sure I'm certified. And it opened a different world for me. And I really, truly started to love what I was doing with human resources.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I used to joke in the beginning, if I can get a crying actress back on stage, I can get a person back to work, right? You know, it's the same approach. You just have to understand people. I'm a wonderful student of human nature. You know, my experience clothing people for more than 2 decades has given me an insight into just people in general. And, you know, that makes a huge difference in sort of everything you do if you understand people.
Well, you're also project manager for the St. Petersburg Foundation.
Yes.
Right? Which is the philanthropic arm of the St. Petersburg Group. This would have something to do with the Lehman Exchange?
So what I do for so the press, as much as I love it, it's kind of my side hustle. It is not my full-time job. A lot of people, when especially some of my authors, don't realize that. When they first sit with me, they think that this is all I do. Mm. So my full-time job, I actually work for the St. Petersburg Group, yeah. And that is a consulting firm. We do we do a lot of civic projects in the St. Pete and Pinellas County area. And what that basically means is we try to do good. We try to find projects that are going to benefit our community, and they're going to bring all the good things together for life here in the St. Pete and Pinellas area. Yeah. We are in the middle of a very large-scale public-private partnership with Pinellas County, working in the Lielman community, which if you're not aware, Lielman is an area just outside of the St. Pete city limits, off of 54th Avenue North. And there, you know, it's a very socioeconomic difficult area, right? And they've been designated as a CRA, which is a community redevelopment area. And we are running, when I say we, St. Petersburg Group and our nonprofit arm, the St. Petersburg Foundation,
yeah.
are running the Lielman Exchange Community Center in partnership with Pinellas County. And we're providing what we call a collective impact service approach, which means, you know, what I always say is one nonprofit is not going to be able to save the world, right? No matter how great that nonprofit is, no matter how enriched their mission is, you can't solve poverty with one nonprofit. But if all the nonprofits can come together at the same table, we play to each other's strengths, we can solve poverty. We can solve, you know, gaps in education. We can make big scale, sustainable change for communities that need us. And that's the whole approach in Lielman. So we don't just run a community center. We run a service hub. We run this collective impact activation board that brings together, at this point, we have more than 79 nonprofit organizations that have come to us and said, we love what you're doing in Lielman. How can we help?
I think what you've done in Lielman, is it Lielman or Lielman? Let me start over.
So the locals call it Lielman.
Yeah.
And they drop that second L. I live in Lielman. I'm a newbie. I've only lived in Lielman 20 years. My husband's family is fourth generation. Uh-huh. So they all say Lielman. And locals are, my husband has told me locals are called Lielmanites, like Lielmanites, but Lielmanites.
Well, what I was going to say is the changes are noticeable. You know, there's a sense of pride over there, which maybe they didn't have so much of before. But, you know, in those events that are going on over there, and there is that community hub now. And, you know, you can see that you're having an effect. And that's kind of part of the thrill of doing those sorts of things.
Yeah, the goal with projects like this is you can't come into a community and tell them what they need.
Mm-hmm.
You come into a community and you ask them what they need. And they'll tell you. They'll tell you exactly what they need. And mm-hmm. the pride was always there. It's a tight-knit community. A lot of the families have been there many generations. And they love being in Lielman. They identify as Lielman residents.
Mm-hmm.
But what they were missing at the time when we started this project was, you know, all of the great perks that a municipality provides. They're unincorporated pocket of Pinellas County, right? They're not a town. They don't have a grocery store. They don't have a post office. They don't have a bank. There's all of these things that are sort of missing because they're not part of the city of St. Pete. They're not part of Pinellas Park. They're kind of stuck between them. And they want to stay that way. They want to stay identified as the Lielman community. But they also want, you know, roads without potholes, and they don't want open ditches, and they, you know, they want streetlights. And those are all the things that, you know, a city or a town or a municipality would provide to a community.
So it's county government.
It's county government.
Right.
Right. So in a very bold move, Pinellas County designated that area as a CRA. It was the first CRA they've ever designated. And they firmly acknowledged that Lealman needed them in a way that you know, many communities in Pinellas County don't, because they don't have this municipality.
Right.
And so the Pinellas County has made an incredible investment in the area. They've, you know, they've upgraded all kinds of things for, you know, streetscaping and placemaking, and they brought people together from the organizations that have already been doing amazing work in Lealman for many decades. And we've come together with an events committee, and we just had our Christmas tree lighting on December 1st. That's mm-hmm. the second annual Christmas tree lighting. Lealman has two beautiful parks. They've never had a Christmas tree before last year. We have a Honey and Arts Festival in February, which we're about to do our second annual Honey and Arts.
I remember the first one very well.
Live music. Yep. We've partnered with the local beekeepers to sell local honey products. And, you know, there's food trucks. It's a great time. And then 4th of July. Last year, we had our first 4th of July. This past year, we had our first 4th of July celebration in Lealman. And we had real fireworks, like the real legit fireworks.
What's the name of that park there? What's that
it's
called?
It's Rainieri Park.
Rainieri Park. That's right. We are actually out of time. I could talk to you forever, and we do talk a lot. And pause, cut this part out because sometimes the gears turn. We've been speaking with Amy J. Cianci. St. Petersburg Press is quite an asset to this city. I'm proud to be at least a little part of it. Amy, thank you for being with me today.
This has been a great conversation, Bill. Thanks for having me.
It has, and I think a lot of people who know you will be interested in hearing a lot of your backstory. And, you know, I didn't know some of that stuff, so here we go. So, listen, it's a happy new year to you, and onward to 2024, I guess.
Yeah. We've got a big year for St. Petersburg Press in 2024. I'm really looking forward to it.
From stpetecatalyst.com.